Hello, I'm Lisa Heineman, and I'd like to welcome you to the premiere broadcast of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies, part of the New Books Network. Together with my co-host, Johanna Schön, I'll be bringing you interviews with authors about their outstanding new work on gender and sexuality. We have a very special guest to help us launch our new channel. She's Mara Vistendahl, author of Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls, and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. This is an incredibly important book. I recommend it highly. I teach an undergraduate course on gender, sexuality, and human rights, and the class attracts a pretty well-informed bunch of students. But when we get to the subject of sun preference and its consequences, hundreds of millions of girls and women simply missing from the planet. The most common response I get from students is, I had no idea. I thought that I at least knew a thing or two about the topic, but after reading Mara's book, I'm going to be scrambling to update my lectures. Through deep investigative reporting, Mara takes us to parents, doctors, demographers, economists, a wide cast of characters, all with a hand in the phenomenon of sex-selective abortion. She shows us the dire consequences, because now the first generation of babies born to parents who could select according to sex have grown up, and a generation of young men unable to find mates has created a market for bride-selling and trafficking. Perhaps most shocking to Western audiences will be Mara's findings about how sex-selective abortion came to be so widespread in Asia. This is not a simple matter of cultural prejudice facilitated by technology. Instead, it's a tale of Western population planners frantic about population growth in underdeveloped countries who hoped that enabling parents to select the sex of their children would convince them to stop having so many. And in the end, the story comes back home. In the United States, couples undergoing in vitro fertilization also often select for sex. Next semester, all my students will be reading Mara Vistendahl's book. You should read it too. Please join us for the interview. Hello, Mara Vistendahl is our guest today. She's author of a wonderful new book, Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men, by Public Affairs Book. This is a sobering work about sex-selective abortion in Asia and elsewhere, about the practice and about its effects. As a historian, I'm also particularly interested in her story of how we came to be at this situation. Not quite as simple a story as a cultural preference for sons. We'll have a chance to talk about all of these things with Mara, but I'd like to welcome you first to the show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm very delighted. Let me just start out by asking you a little bit about your own background. How did you get into this line of work? How did you come to be a science journalist? And how did you come to this work?
Sure. Well, I was born in Minnesota into a family that had some background in Asia. Quite typically a Scandinavian family. But my mother had grown up partly in Taiwan and Singapore and Malaysia, and had studied Chinese. And when she divorced my father, when I was five, she moved in with a Chinese woman who was a good friend of hers, and who also had was also a single mother. And so I grew up with my brother and I, and my kind of Chinese brother. We grew up all in one household for a while, and so very early on, I got interested in Chinese culture. I heard the language a little bit at home, and started studying then myself in high school. And when I graduated from college and finished journalism school, I moved to China to start out there as a freelance journalist. And so really I was interested first and foremost in China and the Chinese language, and then from there my interests expanded into other areas. After being there for a few years, there were a number of issues that I ended up reporting on again and again, and there was one that I just never really understood. That was the sex ratio imbalance. It was something that would come up in the news from time to time. You'd see these numbers every time a new survey came out, every time a new kind of sample survey or a new census came out in China. And the numbers are really dramatic. They show 5 boys born for every 4 girls. The most recent census found 118 boys for 100 girls. And I just felt that this wasn't an issue that was very well explained. I had trouble really wrapping my head around it, and particularly how girls were disappearing and how couples were really opting for boys at a time when, in many ways, women and girls were better off than ever before in China, where there have been a lot of important social changes. And the big story of China is development and just moving forward, and that goes for women as well as men. So it was just this question in my mind: why is this happening now? Of course, I'd grown up with a very strong Chinese woman, and with the sense of, you know, the culture supports some good degree of gender equality, and then I wanted to understand, well, what's going on now that fewer women are being born.
Right, so we might have an expectation that, you know, if things are getting a little bit better for women, or women are getting greater social status, a little more economic autonomy, that this would be a good time for a woman. But exactly at this time, the sex ratio really gets askew. Talk to us a little bit about the demographics. What's a normal sex ratio? What becomes an alarming sex ratio? How do you get to your number of 160 million missing girls and women in Asia?
Well, in the average human population, the sex ratio of birth is around 105 boys for every 100 girls. So slightly more boys are born than girls. But by the time we get to adulthood, that pretty much evens out for reasons we don't fully understand. But in most populations, it's somewhat balanced, and maybe war throws it off or migration. But until the 1980s, and we hadn't seen significantly skewed sex ratios at birth. This is a new phenomenon. It's come up in part because of ultrasound, able to identify the sex of the fetus in the second trimester or even earlier. So women are finding out the sex of the baby and then aborting based on their preference.
And how do we, you studied this phenomenon particularly in Asia, but I was interested to learn from your book that it's not limited to Asia. You find it in Albania, you're finding it in the Balkans. Talk a little bit about the geography here.
Sure. I was originally just interested in how this is happening now in China at a time when the country is developing so quickly. But then as I started looking into it, I saw that, you know, not just India, which is the other country that's often mentioned in coverage of sex selection, but also in the Balkans, as you said, in Albania, Vietnam, South Korea, Taiwan, and parts of Singapore. I mean, just a wide range of countries that more boys are being born than girls, significantly more boys. And I mean, the ratios that would not be possible in nature. And what's common to these countries is that to some degree they're all developing pretty quickly. I mean, these aren't the poorest countries in the world. India also moving ahead very, very rapidly. South Korea, Taiwan, of course, were the, you know, two of the Asian tigers in the 1980s and 1990s. And so then, I mean, this puzzle just got bigger for me. You have a group of countries with very different cultures, very different political histories and political systems today, but the same problem happening in all of these places.
And why is it? What are the common factors?
Well, that took some talking to demographers to figure out. I started my reporting, and throughout my reporting, I went to 9 countries altogether, and I spoke with a lot of parents, a lot of people on the ground to get their sense of what was going on. But it really took talking to a demographer named Christoph Gilmoto, who is working on this on a global scale. And he's looked at all of these different countries and kind of tried to wrap his head around what's common to all of them. And it took talking to him to get a sense of what's really happening for me. One of the common factors is that in all these places, the birth rate has fallen very significantly in the past 3 to 4 decades. So in China, you have the one-child policy, which has, of course, put pressure on couples to limit their, limit themselves to 1 or 2 children. But also in India, the birth rate's fallen. And in Korea, the average woman had 6 children in the in 1960, and today she has just over 1. Same thing happening in the Balkans. Same thing happening in Eastern Europe, in Albania. So people in the past 30 to 40 years, people just having far fewer children. And of course, if you're a woman in a culture where there is pressure to have a son, and suddenly you're only having 1 child instead of 5, that really limits the chances that you're going to get the son. And so that's a significant factor. The other thing is just the overall level of medical technology improving. So women having more access to ultrasound, giving birth in hospitals, something that happens as countries develop, as people move to cities. And then the other thread of the story, the thread that is not so easy to tell, particularly in the context of American politics, is that abortion rates have been pretty high in some of these countries as well, and that there is a history of abortion being introduced not as a woman's right, but as a method of population control. So these are the commonalities, but then from one place to the next, people gave all sorts of different local reasons for why they needed to have a son.
Right. So this is an interesting combination of factors all coming together. It sounds like, in a sense, if a woman's having 4 or 5 kids and the first 1 or 2 are daughters, then you keep trying for a son, right? But if you're only going to have 1 or 2, pressure's on. Like you say, the part of the story that's very, very hard to tell is the influence of the West and the scare of the so-called population bomb, Paul Ehrlich's famous book. And I wonder if you could talk about that, because I think that is a less known part of the story. The role of Western population fears, the role of Western technologies and medical professionals.
Mm-hmm, sure. Well, traditionally, the sex selection's been told as a when it is explained in the press to some degree in the reports that NGOs put out, it's explained as the product of cultural traditions. So the argument goes that these are cultures where there's a very strong emphasis on having a son. There's a lot of pressure on women to have one. And generally, in the overall culture, just measures that promote having, women have lower status, that sort of thing. And you'll see these old adages cited. In China, there's a practice of naming your daughter something like Lai Di, which means bring of brother. And that was something that people did in villages a few 40 years ago. It's a very sexist practice. But what I found is that that's really only a maybe very small part of the story, if that is the story. And that there's this other thread of Western involvement in population policies of Asian countries that is at least as important, if not much more important, in terms of getting us to the situation today when we have so many more boys born than girls.
Right. Because some preference didn't automatically translate into selective abortion until the last couple of decades, right?
So no,
something obviously changed from generations and generations of tradition, right?
Sure. I mean, one doctor in India told me, well, if it was just the fact that we wanted a son, and then girls would have disappeared from India 400 or 500 years ago.
Right.
And you had female infanticide happening at moments throughout Indian and Chinese history, but not nearly on the same scale as sex selective abortion happens today, and never continuously. Mm-hmm. So I was in India interviewing doctors and interviewing activists, and they have a pretty dark history of population control in that country. And several people I spoke with said, well, you might want to look into that history when you're exploring this issue. We think there's a link. And so this was a totally new thread to the story to me, but I looked into it, and I think there is a significant link. I mean, it goes back to the 1950s when we had reliable population projections for the first time. The United Nations was issuing numbers looking at possible population growth 20 to 30 years out, and people were living longer than ever before. There were recent advances in public health and fewer people dying from tuberculosis, and especially in developing countries, just a lot of people living into old age who wouldn't have reached that age in the 1920s, 1930s. And as a result, there was a lot of concern over what became known as the population bomb or the population explosion. And eventually this heightened into something like hysteria. What's going to happen if people keep having children and we don't take any measures to stop them? So there were real reasons for being concerned, but particularly in the context of 1950s, 1960s politics, where there in America there's also a lot of concern about the spread of communism. The West was losing control over its colonies around the world, and there was also a little bit of a kind of us versus them thing that developed, where you had Westerners worried about the population problem, but specifically worried about China and India and about those countries spiraling out of control. So then at the time, organizations like the Population Council formed, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation all started giving a lot of money toward population control. Planned Parenthood was actually originally formed as a population control organization, very different from what it does today. Eventually the UN Population Fund formed. And there was a lot of money going into this issue. And one of the strategies that was put on the table eventually was to find a way to guarantee couples the sex that they prefer when they have children. This was based on a small body of research. So by the 1960s, the population control organizations had done surveys looking at what some of the major barriers to women accepting contraception were. So why were couples continuing to have children? And one of the things that they found was that, particularly in Asia, couples were continuing to have kids because they wanted a boy. So you could actually track when they stopped having kids. This was known as the stopping rule. Did they stop after a girl or did they stop after a boy? And what emerged is that, by and large, around the world, most couples stopped after a boy. So then the idea became, why not figure out a way to guarantee people the boy that they so desire?
So we move from wanting, sort of population planners wanting fewer children, to helping couples select the sex of their child. Mm-hmm. And here's where technology comes in.
Right. Well, the important thing to understand, and then when looking back on this history, is that there was so much hysteria over the population issue and so many strategies on the table And many of them were not voluntary. Several of them were not voluntary. Yeah. They involved incentivizing contraception and even abortion. So paying people to get vasectomies, paying women to have IUDs inserted. There one strategy on the table at one point was to actually fly a plane over India and spray the country with a contraceptive aerial mist. Yes, I don't know what that is, but it sounds scary. And it's, of course, Indians would not have any say in whether this is whether they're sterilized. The U.S. had significant sway in countries like South Korea and India and Taiwan, because of the involvement of population control organizations, because of lobbying by organizations like the World Bank. Significant portion of the health ministry budget in India was going toward population control. Very little money for anything else. So, against that backdrop, people were talking very rationally about implementing population targets, or what became the one-child policy in China. And then something like sex selection, which is entirely voluntary, several of the Western scientists and experts who were promoting it pointed out, you don't need to force people to do it. This is something people will actually leap at the chance to use. So that then became very appealing.
So it's a way of making it less coercive initially. And of course, again, like you say, there's a backdrop of all kinds of, in the 1970s, we have the forced sterilization campaigns in India. So against the background of a lot of coercion, this seems, in a sense, like a kinder, gentler way to have people voluntarily limit the size of their families.
Right, yes. 6 million men sterilized in India in just 1 year. Horrible abuses happening. And I think there was actually a sort of cruel foresight in promoting sex selection, in that we were emerging from the era of eugenics and sort of state-run, top-down policies. And what the backers of sex selection saw was that this was something that was individual. It was a kind of consumer eugenics. And today I think that resonates. I think that's where we're at today. We are moving away from the era of the state meddling in people's business, but you have individual parents making these decisions, and when you add them up, of course, it leads to a huge problem.
Well, and you have this wonderful phrase, or a kind of chilling phrase, of mothers becoming their own eugenicists, which does sort of underlie the way in which this is a voluntary procedure. And it speaks to something else that I think is interesting. I think much of the press coverage we see of this issue implies that the mothers themselves might be vulnerable to, they might be responding to pressures from their husbands, pressures from their in-laws, pressures from the doctors. But you're not quite sure about that. You think the mothers themselves are as much making this choice as anybody else.
Well, today this issue is now very tangled up in abortion politics, and it took some wading through that for me to make sense of it. When I went around and interviewed women, I spoke with several who had sex selective abortions, who'd aborted female fetuses. And one woman in Jiangsu province in China, she told me, I did this on my own. This is a matter of getting face, of earning respect in her city. I'd actually spent quite a bit of time with her and her husband, and she really called the shots in her relationship. She was a very strong Chinese woman, and I think maybe not, it's not the strongest reason for wanting to have a boy, but but I could understand it in the context of contemporary Chinese society, where really people are very concerned with what the neighbors think, with trying to get ahead. And she was living in a community where three boys were being born for every two girls. I mean, you just saw boys everywhere, and she wanted one as well. But where this becomes kind of convoluted is that because abortion rights have come under attack by the Christian right in the U.S. and organizations like the United Nations Population Fund have had their work defunded abroad. They're resistant to say that this is something that women are doing of their own accord. It's, I think, to some degree, an easier argument for them to make to say that this is happening against the backdrop of gender oppression and women are being forced or strongly encouraged to have boys. And I found a number of documents that the United Nations Population Fund sends out to its country offices saying you should promote these stories, play up these stories, and downplay the other story, downplay stories of women making their making this decision themselves. But of course, reality is much more complex. And as a journalist, I'm interested in the reality.
Right, right. And towards the end of the book, there's a discussion of, like you say, you have the UN Population Fund, which is concerned with attacks on its autonomy, and you have Western feminists who are really at a loss for how to address this issue.
Yes, I've been heartened since the book came out. I've seen and have met with a number of feminist groups in the U.S. who are taking this on. They realize that in the end, it's not just about abortion. It's really about selection and whether parents should be allowed to select these traits in their children. And the issues are far from going away. They're just heating up. Now we have fetal blood tests. Just by taking a sample of the mother's blood at 7 weeks of pregnancy, you can determine the sex and other traits as well. We have sex selection during in vitro fertilization, which doesn't involve abortion at all.
Nice.
But is still very troubling at the level of selection, at the fact that parents are really foisting these expectations on their future children. So So there are feminist groups that are taking it on, but for the most part, I found much more happening around the issue in Asia and not that much on the international scale. And that was disappointing. I think this really should be an international issue. It should be something that UN agencies address head on and something that people in the U.S. know about. I actually spoke with a number of people who told me this, a number of readers in the U.S. who told me this is something I hadn't heard about. I didn't know that there were millions of fewer women being born, and that is troubling for me.
Yeah. Well, and you're absolutely right that there is, of course, in Asia, they are dealing with the consequences of this. You talk about that. We've now had sex selection going on for a generation in many spots in Asia. So there's now a generation of young men who exist in a world of significant demographic imbalance. So their communities are having to deal with the consequences in a way that, of course, the West is not yet dealing with. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, because the consequences are not pretty.
That's true, and it makes it even more pressing for women's groups and groups that care about women's rights to take this issue on. Early when the West kind of first started to acknowledge the practice of sex selection in Asia, there were some particularly economists, actually, that proposed that as women become scarce, that they demand for them will increase, and people will start to value them more. That, you know, it's kind of the simple supply and demand relationship, that, you know, eventually couples will start to have more girls, and this will all even out. And what we've seen is actually, to some degree, the opposite happening, in that women are, there are no, much more in demand across Asia. I mean, you have tens of millions of women missing from China, from India, in China and India, in Northwest India. An estimated 15% of men will not be able to find a female partner by the 2020s, and so huge gaps. But the women are not being more valued in the way we would like them to be more valued, unfortunately. It's the prices of brides are going up. Women are being bought and sold. They're being trafficked. So on a very crude level, they're more valuable, but they don't control their own value. I spent some time looking at the what are called marriage tours, which is this industry that's developed in South Korea and Taiwan, where men who have trouble finding wives in their own communities go to poorer countries, often to Vietnam, on these one-week marriage tours to buy wives. It's a little bit like the mail-order bride industry in the U.S., but much more pervasive, to the point that whole communities in Taiwan, the men are married to Vietnamese wives. It's brought with it a lot of social problems. I spoke with some of the women who are brought over. For some, you know, the main issue is that they don't speak the same language as their husbands, and that they have trouble adapting. They're dependent on them for immigration status. But there are also cases of women being beaten. There are shelters that have been set up. On the other end, in Vietnam, I went to an island where so many women have left for Taiwan that locals have started referring to it as Taiwan Island. And it's become a hugely systematized thing. A man pays $10,000. He that covers the cost of the flight, flight to Ho Chi Minh City, room and board on the other end, and the wife. And then in China and India, on the other hand, many men can't afford that level of bride buying even, and so they are finding wives through illegitimate means, through trafficking, and those women are often not going willingly. Their parents are buying and selling them. They're coming sometimes from countries like Burma or North Korea. So huge abuses, and it's by and large it's the so sex selection starts in major urban areas. It starts paradoxically actually among the upper classes of a society. And then when it comes time to marry, those men have a bit of an easier time. They can typically attract women from other regions. But it's the men at the very bottom of the social scale, in poor areas, rural areas, who have a lot of trouble. And so it's those places that are becoming destinations for trafficked women. Mm-hmm. And
those, you know, places also, in a sense, get emptied out of their women, sort of displacing the demographic imbalance, right?
Exactly, right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And in the end, of course, there aren't enough women to go around. Now, Vietnam has now developed its own problem in that in the past 10 years, Vietnamese have started selecting for boys. So, you know, traditionally they had a surplus of women because of the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. and this trade developed in part after the war. A lot of men had died, and there were then women to spare. But today, the situation looks very different.
So, Mara, did anyone see this coming? I mean, in some senses, this shouldn't be rocket science, right? To know if you have sex selection at the point of birth, then 20 years down the road, you're going to have a significant demographic imbalance. And you talk a little bit, obviously, about the economists who had a kind of simple supply-demand, you know, fantasy about what would happen. But you do also talk about a couple other people who had, in a sense, a deeper moral vision about what this might bring.
Well, what I found fascinating and somewhat disturbing in reading the discussions over sex selection technologies in the 60s and 70s was that there were people who saw the side effects of sex selection even then. You know, we mentioned Paul Ehrlich earlier. He proposed finding a good method of sex selection in the population bomb. It was almost a mainstream idea. But there was one microbiologist in particular named John Postgate who wrote an article for The New Scientist in the early 1970s saying, you know, these are some of the drawbacks of sex selection. It's going to create an atmosphere in which women are under threat, where women may need to keep them under lock and key. They may not be able to freely work. And I don't know if he was exaggerating in his predictions or not, but those were all, there's a degree of truth to all of those. But what was striking was that still, despite that, he came out and said at the end, well, in the end, sex selection is really the way to go. This is something we have to do because the population problem is so pressing. And what I think is particularly disturbing about that is that there was so much, a situation where there was so much concern over a problem that people really lost sight of some of the side effects in the solution. And I think it's probably significant that women did not occupy significant positions of power in the population control movement. Also, people of color, people from the developing world, and these are mostly gatherings of white men sitting around talking about the future of the world. But on the other hand, I think we can see really a cautionary tale in that. You know, if we focus so exclusively on one issue, and then we kind of dig ourselves into a hole with the solution to that issue.
Yeah, you've written a little bit about the case of South Korea, for example, which was almost sort of a canary in the coal mine. I mean, it was in the Americans' sights early on. There was a military occupation there. It was early on the wave of sex selection, and now actually has evened out the ratio of births of boys to girls. You sort of come to this present moment where it looks like there might be a bit of a turnaround, but you actually don't see such a hopeful story in the South Korean example.
Well, the story of South Korea is complex. The narrative that has emerged in the Western press is that South Korea's sex ratio at birth balanced out, became much more normal by 2005. And the story is that as a result of introducing a lot of gender-sensitive policies, kind of paying more attention to women's rights, the government and the broader civil society created an atmosphere where Koreans wanted to have girls, where suddenly girls were more valued, and that's what you see today. What you see today is the result of that. And when I went and actually interviewed people in Korea, I interviewed mothers, doctors, women's rights activists, government officials, and then asked them what they thought about that, I heard a very different story. Today, Korea has a very conservative government. There is actually a backlash against abortion rights. The abortion doctors are being put in jail. It's not a great moment for women's rights. At the same time, the sex ratio at birth has become balanced, But what's happened at the same time is that the birth rate has fallen to such a point where, you know, at one point it was the lowest birth rate of any country in the world. So people are not having that many children, and the government is now extremely focused on increasing the birth rate and convincing women to have more children. That, I think, should be a more worrying issue for the world. I mean, it's also a situation where women's bodies are at the center of government policy yet again. I mean, you had decades where the goal was convincing Korean women to have fewer children, and sex selection was one of the side effects of that. And then now today, kind of becoming swinging in the other direction.
So it's a little hard to see where that's going to actually end up. There's no reassurance that we're now settled at something that is, you know, genuinely egalitarian in any way.
But demographers don't think that sex selection will be around forever in any of the countries where it's taken hold, or that it will be practiced on the scale that it's practiced. But South Korea, it still has a lot of issues to deal with. So because the birth rate's not very high, you don't have many more women being added to the population, and the country's going to have to deal with millions more men than women. Over the decades to come.
It's not really a corrective. No. And you actually do have an interesting language there of, you know, families where the birth rate is so low that in a sense they're doing number selection rather than sex selection. You know, families that are that just want to have a child. And at that point, whether it's a girl or a boy or a girl becomes less important, but there's a lot of unhappiness around the very, very low birth rate.
Sure. Yeah, I would have loved to give my book a happy ending. Actually,
well, it looked like you were looking for one. Well, let me take us to your epilogue, where you come back to the United States, where you know, of course, sort of on the cutting edge of technology, where we see sex selection here at the level of pre-implantation around in vitro fertilization, and. This you describe as, you know, of course, it is also sex selection and potentially selection according to all sorts of other traits. But the sort of cultural dialogue about it in the United States is very different than the way Americans talk about sex selection when Asians do it.
That's true, right? The language is very different. In the U.S., we say family balancing. That, you know, implies that couples have a right to have equal numbers of boys and girls, even if nature doesn't give them that equal number. In Asia, of course, it's called sex selection. But if you look at what's actually happening, it's pretty similar. Americans are by and large not doing it through abortion. They're using in vitro fertilization. They're using a technique called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, but they. Also, like Asians, they wait until they have one or two children of the opposite sex. They're also putting these expectations on their future child. And I mean, in that sense, I think the Chinese couple that really wants to have a boy because they believe he's going to carry on the family line and he's going to sweep the ancestral grave and all of these things, they have a bit in common with the American couple that really wants a girl because they want to dress her in pink dresses or have princess parties or, you know, whatever the reason is. In both cases, there's this expectation of how the child's going to turn out. And, of course, children often surprise us.
Right, right. So there's the demographic imbalance, and then there's sort of the internal pressure within families, right? You know, the pressure on each child to be what the parents desire for it becomes great. And, of course, anybody who's, you know, grown up to be queer or transgender or anything like that, or just a little bit unorthodox, you know, can speak to those sort of gendered expectations and the complications they cause.
Oh, definitely. And what I find worrying is that the U.S. has incredibly lenient policies governing or not governing assisted reproduction. And so techniques like PGD are freely available for sex selection, for social reasons. And that's in contrast with most of the Western world, where this is pretty strictly regulated.
What kinds of regulations do we see elsewhere? You talk a little bit about Europe, of course, being a place where the population is wealthy enough that such techniques are more broadly used than in poorer parts of the world.
Well, in most of Western Europe, you can't go through PGD simply because you want to have a boy or a girl. As a result, the U.S. has become a destination for British couples, Canadian couples, Western European couples. And unfortunately, in part because we have a free market healthcare system and this tradition of not strictly regulating healthcare, that's what's happened. We have this fertility industry it's really a business. It's really a money-making enterprise. And sex selection is something that can be marketed. And it can be marketed to a group of people who are not in conventional sense sick in any way. They wouldn't have a reason to go to a fertility specialist except that they really want a girl or a boy.
And they would rather do it this way than via abortion. This somehow feels cleaner in some way, or again, it's an expensive option.
Frankly, I think ethically, yeah. I think there's no doubt that ethically it's much easier for a woman to select embryos than it is to terminate a pregnancy, and that's something that Asians would I agree with as well. I'm quite sure. I mean, PGD is also taking off in the developing world. Clinics are opening in South Korea, and at that level, it's very worrying. I mean, as the technology advances, and then the ethical burden becomes really much lower. People start to question, well, why shouldn't I do this?
And certainly, one of the things we learned from your book in terms of the last several decades is that it took some real work to get Asian women to be willing to have abortions on this scale in the first place. Abortion was not conventionally accepted, and it took a lot of work on the part of Western population planners to make them feel that abortion was okay. And that then helped to create an environment where sex selective abortion, well, why not? So that the ethical hardening, in a sense, at least within certain cultural contexts.
Well, as a journalist, I was reading a lot of what my colleagues are writing about abortion in Asia. And you see this idea cropping up that, and particularly in China, that this is something that people don't have the same ethical issues over. There's not the same controversy over when life begins. It's just not an issue. And that may be true today, that people are remarkably open and pragmatic, I suppose, about abortion. But what I found was that it wasn't always the case at all. And the reality that existed when Western population planners arrived in the 1950s, and not just in China, which was a bit more closed, but also South Korea, Taiwan, and India, it was a very different landscape then. And there was a lot of work that had to be done just to convince women that it wasn't a good thing to have as many kids as you could. The concept of femininity really centered around having five or six kids and not sticking to one or two. And certainly not getting rid of unwanted pregnancies. There wasn't such a thing.
Right. So there is a story here of really American pressure, Western pressure to accept abortion. Of course, very different from the international scene today, right? Where there's certainly American pressure internationally to clamp down on abortion. The political scene has changed. We see members of the Republican Party in earlier decades very, very actively promoting abortion abroad as a means of population control.
Oh, yes. It's changed dramatically in just a few decades. I mean, Henry Kissinger was a big advocate of abortion overseas. I mean, the hypocrisy existed early on. There were certainly people who supported legalizing abortion overseas and didn't do anything to back its legalization at home.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's true that the dialogue has changed significantly, and abortion politics continues to shape this issue, and it's one of the reasons we haven't had a reasoned dialogue over sex selection in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, Maura, this is absolutely fascinating and hugely important material. Like you say, I think a lot of us in the West aren't really fully aware of the massive phenomenon of sex selection in Asia. But asking that question also brings up questions about population policies here at home and the use of technologies and how we ourselves both promote sex selection abroad and different kinds of selection here at home. Let me ask you another question. This is sort of our traditional wrap-up question on the New Books Network, which is, what are you doing now?
Well, I was hired by Science Magazine not that long ago, and I've been in the Netherlands as I was writing my book, and now I'm moving back to Beijing, and I will be reporting on any number of issues.
And where will we be able to read your work?
In Science Magazine.
Excellent. Okay, well, we look forward to it. My guest has been Maura Vistendahl, author of Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls, and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. A wonderful book, and I recommend you read it. Thanks so much for being on our show, Maura.
Well, thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've been listening to an interview with Maura Vistendahl, author of Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls, and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. I'm Lisa Heineman, your co-host of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies. Please join us again. Thanks for listening.